You're listening to the Sportsman's Nation Podcast Network, brought to you by Federal Premium Ammunition. Now, Federal has come out with a new turkey load called the Heavyweight TSS, or the Heavyweight Tungsten Super Shot. Now, this is a tungsten alloy material, and it's 18 grams per cubic centimeter density. Now, what this means is it's 22% higher than standard tungsten and 56% higher than lead. So it is a very dense material, and it has the ability to travel at high velocities and continue that velocity at longer distances. It has deadly patterning, and it also has something called flight control flex, and that is when that rear braking wad performs flawlessly through ported and standard turkey chokes. So if you want to find out more information about the Heavyweight Tungsten Super Shot, visit federalpremium.com. And while you're there, don't forget to check out their podcast and their blogs. Tons of great content.
Welcome to the Land and Legacy Podcast. We're your hosts, Adam Keith
and Matt Dye.
This is your number one resource for all things land.
If you're interested in conservation, habitat management, hunting strategy, and rural real estate, this is the podcast for you.
All right, guys, welcome back to another Land and Legacy Podcast. Before we get kicked off, we want to thank one of our partners to make this podcast happen. That is First Light. You can check them out at firstlight.com. If you've watched our videos, shoot, if you've even heard us talk about it on the podcast, we've been wearing First Light for about a year now, through deer season, turkey season, and
yep.
and kind of all arise from our inability to stay warm in the deer stand.
Our troubles.
And,
trials and
we
troubles.
We decided to go with something that was a little less clothing, a little more gear-oriented, and high-quality gear. And, man, we just could not be more thrilled to be wearing First Light, and now even more thrilled to be partnered up with First Light and them supporting our podcast. So check it out at firstlight.com. Before I kick that off, you got anything you want to say?
I was just going to say, great conservation partner too.
Yeah,
which is like, oh, you have great gear. Oh, and you love conservation. Sweet.
Yeah,
like that like mentality of what it is they're trying to accomplish as a business and as a message. It's like, oh yeah, walking stride, kind of with them. So that's also a definite positive. Got the right mindset of where they want to do and make an impact for hunters, for land, for habitat, and the critters that we chase. So I love that part.
Yes. So we're going to kick this podcast off and jump into a little bit of a podcast regionally specific for some of you guys. It's kind of a big region, but let's just say the gist of it is you guys in the northern climate. I just got back from a several-day trip in Pennsylvania, and Matt just got back from a trip in Minnesota. And for our consulting business, if you guys didn't know, you've been living under a rock if you've listened to this podcast and you didn't realize that, but we're consultants. And so with you being in Pennsylvania, or you being in Minnesota,
yep,
me returning to Pennsylvania, but you in Minnesota, I believe that makes it 27th or 28th state.
Yep.
And I know Kyle's headed to Florida, mm-hmm, in about a week or so to work way down south in Florida to help a big ranch and the quail population down there. So that might make it the 29th
state.
That's the 29th. I don't know.
Yep.
We've been too busy to even formulate that. With our trip, it's kind of a great reminder, a great conversation. We have a lot of listeners in, well,
both
Michigan,
of
Minnesota,
yeah,
Pennsylvania,
Wisconsin.
Northern Ohio.
Shout out to you guys. New
and
York
so,
and Maine as well.
Even Canada.
Even
we've had
Canada,
several people write
sure
in
have
from Canada. But with that being said, it's a totally different beast when it comes to managing compared to what we do in southern Missouri, or especially what we do in Mississippi, Georgia, South Carolina. Now, the principles are the same, but the way, mm-hmm, we attack it and the way we're laying out projects, totally different.
Yes.
Things that we are going to talk about in this podcast, we would probably get ran out of the state if we went down to Arkansas and said, we're going to do this.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
they'd
yeah.
be like, get out of here.
Out of here, dog.
Yeah.
I think and it just brings to the importance of, as everyone is out there consuming information, varied resources, and reading articles and watching videos and wherever you're getting information, always be mindful of where that, I don't want to say information coming from, but I mean that regionally.
Yeah.
Like, what works in some regions, that may work fantastic, and it doesn't mean it's applicable in your region. It means that maybe you can learn from that and say, okay, I understand that. I can see where that plays a role, but then tailor make that into how it's most applicable in your region. We can't just say, hey, soybeans is great here, so it's going to be great down here, or it's going to be, you know.
Standing corn is the best late season food plot. And then you go down into South Carolina or way down south and you get standing corn, you may sit there and never get consumed.
We're talking in contrasting areas that are consistently sub-zero, 2 feet of snow for months out of the year, compared to areas that are winters or average temperature 48, 50 degrees. Like, you're world of difference.
If you look at a deer in Minnesota, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, the biggest stress period is that late winter, early spring.
Mm-hmm.
Which, for some of us, we may just let our mind drift and say, oh, that's like a month-long window. No, not up there. When it starts snowing in October, and it doesn't melt and start greening up till May, that's a big window.
Very large window. And I mean, I talked with one of the gentlemen up there. It was like mid-April, late April. You still get some snow flurries. That's not a big deal. It's very normal.
Yeah.
Early snow for them, where I was at, specifically on one of the more northern locations, a 1st of September wasn't unnormal to get flurries and stuff and start having those temperatures. So you just look at that growing season and what can happen in that growing season, because we've talked about it time and time again on the podcast, is as managers, land managers, you need to work in growing seasons. But if you have a 9-month growing season compared to a 5-month growing season, things are going to be different. Things are going to look a lot different.
And so you look at that stress period in the northern climate being late winter, early spring. But then you go down south, and that stress period is summer.
Yeah.
Where it could be late over summer. 100 degrees for several weeks, month.
A lot of mature plants.
Month and a half.
Yep.
And really, if you were to take those two, we just talked about those two stress periods down south and up north and say, okay, down south, I want herbaceous plants. I need as much green vegetation and food that's not getting wilted in the fields.
Yep.
And then if I'm going up north, I need that woody browse. I need something that's going to be standing and available in all that snow.
Yes.
And too many times is it a one size fits all recommendation, or where some guys are trying to do something. Hey, I love turnips, and they're planting turnips in their food plots. And it's like, you've got snow over the top of those. Are deer going to be digging through the snow to get to those turnips? I can tell you right now, they don't want to.
Yeah. Is there another option? Like, what else could I do?
Yeah.
Tell me, help me.
Yeah. I don't want to have to pass out shovels to have them digging through snow to get to my food plots. Let's provide food that's going to be above the snow. And, you know, that's the big, Pennsylvania has some, how do I say this? Unique regulations.
Yeah. Let's see. Are you referencing unique
challenges?
Referencing the antlers?
Specifically antlerless regulations.
Okay.
In the antlerless part of Pennsylvania that I was at.
Okay.
Where it was.
So not the antler point restrictions. You're talking antlerless.
No, I'm just harvesting does. I'm just getting into one thing for what I'm
got
talking
it.
About. Yeah. And so, one regulation specifically that's unique. Let's not open that can up. let's not turn over that stone. And here we are. We've got very limited ability to manage a antlerless population.
Mm-hmm.
We know how much we talk so much about. If you're improving your habitat, then your whitetail herd will
grow.
Grow, and you'll start seeing more twins, more triplets. Typically, if you are really making some great moves with your habitat and holding capacity. And so in Pennsylvania, you start all this, there's a chance that you're going to start seeing a population grow. But you don't have the ability, specifically in this part, to go out and shoot 50 does,
mm-hmm.
or 20 does, or 10 does, yeah. even.
50 is extreme, but regardless, you have your set tags,
and
that's it.
Yes. And so I have, I guess we have, but I've worked with them last year and worked again with them this year in a kind of central Pennsylvania, and a couple hundred acres, two different parcels, and mostly timber.
Mm-hmm.
And when you think about a high deer number, yeah, still mostly timber. And I can honestly say that, you know, the hunting heritage in Pennsylvania is thick.
It's strong.
Awesome.
It's really, really cool.
But at the same time, that heritage is also a place that you don't see a lot of people going to Pennsylvania to shoot Boone and Crockett.
Sure. Yeah.
And so it's kind of just a good, I mean, I think a deer camp in Pennsylvania, just fun place. And for these guys,
rich.
One guy is specifically saying, I'd love to shoot a 150 or bigger here.
Mm-hmm.
Not very common in his part of the world.
Nope.
And it's going to be a little bit tricky to do that with having such a high deer density. When I visited last year, he had done some timbering. You know, he bought the farm.
Yep.
And he's actually a logger. And he had cut a bunch of trees, and the regen on those trees that he cut
crossed.
Was just hammered.
They were keeping up over and above them.
If they continued that for another 2 years, those trees were just going to perish. They were going to die. And then you're relying on a young acorn or an acorn to sprout and start to grow and make it through the browse pressure and survive. So the chance of a future in a healthy forest and having young forest available, not only for food and cover, but also just the next timber harvest for the future generation, wasn't going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And
I think that's an important point that most people, they don't know and they can't go into the timber and recognize. But you go to those places where deer densities and no management is happening from a forestry side of things. You have like zero regeneration of hardwood species, and that is an issue. A healthy, sustainable forest is not just big, large trees where you can see 200 yards. Healthy, sustainable forest is something that is showing different age classes. Therefore, there is active management, and we know what the next population or generation is going to be like. We can see it coming on, but when you can't see it, that's like an immediate red light of, what's going to happen here?
Yeah. I see two big beaming red lights. And one of those is deer have become a problem.
Sure.
If you're looking at it from a timber standpoint of going, okay, throw the wildlife out. I'm just trying to make a harvest and set my forest up for a future harvest. The deer aren't allowing that to happen.
That drastic.
It's that bad.
Yeah.
And that's one of the huge problems. And then the other one is just the simple fact that we're trying to, when you think about health of a deer herd, if your biggest stress period
is
late
month?
Winter,
and
we've allowed the deer density to get so high that they're either going to starve if conditions get, you know, you put that stressed deer herd under a magnifying glass,
mm-hmm.
and you give them a really severe winter, they're going to starve, or they're going to be going miles away and try to find food to survive. They're going to be going into town. They're going to do whatever they can. And what's the chances of that nice up-and-coming buck that you had your mind, your heart set on for next year, what's the chances of him making it back to you by the next fall?
Back?
Who knows?
But how about just overall decent condition?
Yeah.
I mean, and not to mention, okay, when we have those certain types of conditions, and I know Pennsylvania has a very large issue specifically across the eastern portion of the state, but incredibly high tick populations as well. We talk about additional stress on individual deer during the summer months. You have build up of leaf litter, duff, and an incredible amount of actual mammals who are hosts for tick populations. Obviously, deer,
yep,
dogs, everything.
Me, while I was there.
Yeah. You just continue to compound those problems, those situations that are, I don't want to say they're not wreaking havoc. However, they are having impacts on the wildlife
just
and individuals.
Added stress.
Yeah. Just add it to the equation.
Add stress of ticks. Add stress of limited food. Add stress of the winter. Add stress of social stress because there's so many deer. No wonder that you're not seeing the giants come out of there. Like,
well, that as well as, which is, this is a great thing, but there's a lot of hunters in Pennsylvania, which again, that is a good thing. That is a great thing. But all of those things combined don't necessarily make it that destination state. And I would say to those people in not just Pennsylvania, the Keystone State, but any state that has a huge reliance of their economy based on like hardwoods, timber, and you have incredibly high deer densities, that's an issue. that's a problem. And you probably also then have a large number of vehicular accidents too, because you got deer everywhere. Everywhere.
Yeah, insurance agents are out there like, shh.
Yeah. It's crazy. crazy.
Yeah, and you know, so I was there last year, and, you know, I met the two landowners, and they explained their goals, what they were shooting for, and, you know, we kind of sat back, and I said, we drove through the property, and it was kind of like, okay. We're looking for limited resources. We're looking for increase.
Looking to address them.
Yep. We're also looking for things that mature deer, because that was a big part of their goals. Yeah. They were wanting to hunt mature deer. So we're trying to find the stuff that mature deer seek.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, where's the thick cover? Where's the cover from 6 foot down? That's high stem count or just shrubby.
Yep.
Where is it? It ain't here. It's somewhere else. And so we got work to do. Where's the young forest? It's gone.
They've eaten it.
Yeah.
Which I don't know if that rings a bell or anything, but we do all talk about the amount of woody browse that deer do eat. There's a great example. Forests aren't even coming back because they eat it. It's a preferential food. Now, granted, when deer are in excess, they eat a lot of different things and forage on things that they probably don't want to. However, deer hammer woody browse, especially in climates and in areas like you were in, central PA.
I think that for me, you know, when you look in those at that climate, woody browse might be the one, like the foundation for me when I'm managing off of it, because not necessarily that I think it's bar none, it's like the most attractive. I just think that it's, if you take 12 months out of the year and you look at a deer's diet, I think that woody browse makes up a huge part of that. At the same time, because it is, we're looking at this most stressful time of the year, and trying to build off of that, then woody browse fills that void.
Well, two, when you look at the state, it's extremely, in most cases, in the east, southeast, and through some other portions of the, there's certainly ag and pasture land, but it is very wooded. So when you were trying to do 80 grit management on it, what do you look at? You say, well, I have from a natural resource standpoint, an abundance of trees.
Yeah.
How am I going to use all these trees that are already here that already have an amazing root system developed? How do I use this resource to benefit deer? Well, shoot, I'm going to cut them. And then you have young forests. So it's like, what's the biggest, quickest thing I can do? Cut the forest.
Yeah. And not just cut the forest, because he's already cut a good portion of this forest. But he didn't cut enough to make a significant impact.
Sunlight-wise, like, or regen-wise?
Both. Because he didn't cut enough trees. He cut a lot of big trees. He cut some good timber, made some money to help pay for the farm.
Mm-hmm.
But, and this is what I love so much about the 80 grit management, is because we try to key in and use big tools or big management practices to manage this farm that are ability, gives you the ability to make money.
Mm-hmm.
And so in this case, when I toured it last year, I looked around, I said, we need to cut more. And fortunately, I mean,
he's not afraid to cut, being a logger.
He's like, you're telling me to cut more trees.
Mm-hmm.
That does not bother me. And I'm like, I'm telling you, we need to cut more trees.
Lots.
And not because I hate trees.
Sure.
But because that's a limited resource here.
And you know how valuable that resource can be in the right condition, the right shape, the right form.
So, you know, a lot of fun stories happen here. Mm-hmm. When I first met this landowner, we talked a lot about big deer. We talked about 150 plus. We talked about growing and holding and hunting and strategically placing. And we do all that with our consulting business. But a lot of people in the process, they get a little tidbit.
Get a lot of good tidbits.
They get a lot of good tidbits along the way to make them hopefully fall in love with more about their farm. And this guy, this year, we were there. I was there last week. And, man, scarlet tanagers everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes, man, that bird app you got is super cool. You got to send that over here. What's he doing? One of the other clients that own a farm just down the road, he's walking on. He goes, he don't even care about these birds. And we were looking at these scarlet tanagers flying around. And I just said, let's just take a minute and think about the appreciation you now have for the birds that are using your farm. And he goes, what in the world did you do to me?
That's a fantastic point to pause on, though, because if you don't, I want to say stop and smell the roses, though, but look at all the other things that benefit from the work that you do. Maybe your goal is killing giant big deer. Great. That's awesome.
We could still do that.
Absolutely. But if that is your only goal, you may be waiting a long time for that. Yep. So while you're doing that, let's slow down and enjoy and see how other animals are benefiting from the work, because they're everywhere, you're saying.
Oh, yeah. So I visited multiple parcels, multiple tracks in that
– right in that area.
Right in that area.
Like, and you're saying, like, within 5 square miles.
Yeah, some a little bit up more in the mountains.
Okay.
But I stayed in the same hotel, if that's tells you anything.
It was fair enough to say same region.
Less than an hour.
Yeah.
And I toured these other three parcels.
That didn't have the
cutting. That about the same size and acreage, give or take a few, 100 acres or so.
A little higher in elevation?
Yeah.
Okay.
But for the most part, not significantly different. And we saw one scarlet tanager, which scarlet tanager, woodland species, woodland bird. So it kind of likes that semi-open forest.
Hmm.
And we saw one.
Yeah.
One of them.
All the other farms
and
that hadn't been
we
cut.
Go to the one farm that had been cut. I bet I saw 50.
Yeah.
They were everywhere. And I mean, if you don't know what a scarlet tanager looks like, it's
a little
similar
red
to the
dart
summer,
flying around.
Summer tanager, but it almost looks like a red bird, like cardinal color, but they take a light and turn it on the inside where they almost glow.
Mm-hmm.
They got black wings, real pretty song, but they're everywhere. And they really key in on insects, which tells us if they're there, they're eating insects.
They're not going to be there if there's not food.
We're creating
there.
A ecosystem or a landscape that's certainly has more insects.
Yeah, and this micro little climate.
Jump back a couple of podcasts, and insects are just as important too, and they're incredibly important right now when you think about turkeys nesting and getting ready to hatch and brood rearing. We need a lot of insects, and voila. So these little birds are telling us we've got quite a few insects. At the same time, you just look around and there's indigo buntings and there's goldfinches. There's all these other birds who also like woodlands. And they're flying around everywhere. Okay, we're starting to get somewhere.
Sure.
And the birds are some of the first signs that we can see if we're going in the right direction.
Absolutely.
And so last year I told the landowner, I said, we need to cut more. And he said, okay, what are we thinking? Do I just need a general TSI, a shelter wood cut? Are we looking at a crop tree release? What are we looking at?
Yep.
And I told him, I said, with you and your ability of what you do for a living, there's a paper mill right back in your town. We have something to that we can do that most people can't.
There's an outlet for lumber.
Most people, when they do a timber harvest, logger comes in, cuts their best trees, they make money, and then they're left with the misfits.
Yeah, the misfits.
Or the next generation that aren't big enough yet to cut. And so you basically have kind of two main schools of trees. You've got big trees that aren't worth anything, and then you've got young trees who are now going to have to compete with those bigger trees that aren't as going to make as financially...
gain is not as good.
Yeah. And so, anyway, so you're left with having to come in and do TSI, thin the junk out, and release those young ones. Well, because there is a paper mill, the landowner had the ability to cut junk.
Which for everyone who's listening and wondering, okay, cool, paper mill, whatever, that's that their size and the scale in which they operate on and the species-wise, they're much less...
Picky
on wood. It's more like wood, bring it here.
Uh-huh.
And so misshapen stuff,
yep.
Much thinner stuff, much smaller DBH.
All the way down to branches, like 6 inches. Yep.
You're able to take, so you don't have a bunch of tops laying everywhere too.
Yeah.
Those tops can even be processed. And so having that resource right there allows him, one, to make more money, but then two,
make a healthier forest. A
healthier forest and do that TSI mechanically with big equipment, take out the big trees, the money or the higher dollar trees, but then while he's in there at the same exact time, do the TSI work, which is like, yeah, how do I get into that game?
Yeah, so when I talked to him last year, it was like, okay, yeah, we're going to cut more trees, do a crop tree release.
Yeah. And so a lot of what? Northern red oak, white oak, and chestnut oak.
Yeah. Yep. So basically,
black oak in there too, mix?
Yep. It had some black oak. And then also, you know, he had some crop trees that were hickory. So we're adding some diversity to the forest.
There's bears there.
Yeah. And so he went in. And so generally when we write plans, there's, okay, first step, whatever their goals are. But let's just say on average, first step is bedding thickets. We need to get some micro clear cuts out there. And so he had, I don't know how many I put on this. This is in between, it's around 350 acres.
Okay.
And, you know, I think probably a dozen, I'd say, clear cuts. And generally, it's like, let's shoot for hopefully half this year and half next year.
Sure.
Or a quarter this year and a quarter.
Once you get the skills going up, yeah. Hit hard.
We're just going to keep trying to expand. And then we give them a TSI area that may involve a combination of sorts just so we can get them to make the improvements as quickly as possible. And so it may be cutting and felling. It may be hack and squirt. It may be a combination of sorts. It may be even getting a timber harvest in there.
Yeah.
This landowner did all but like one main unit, maybe two main units. And I have only like six on the property.
You're talking about from a TSI standpoint.
Timber stand improvement standpoint. He did four out of the six.
In 12 months.
In 12 months. And he did every single one of his clear cuts.
I like that.
So you want to talk about changing the landscape.
You want to talk about Regen City. It's right
that,
there.
That's what our plan was. And, you know, I made the post last year where I think I put on a social media said that we're attempting to create some young forest and do some habitat things in Pennsylvania. And we had several questions where guys were like, you're gonna have to cut a bunch of timber if you think you're going to be able to get ahead of the deer.
Sure.
And so I visited in May, yeah, and I talked it over with the landowner. And he's like, let's do it. And he goes, you tell me.
You probably got on the plane May of last year to come home, and he jumped.
I was right at, it was 2 degrees when I was there in January.
Oh, that was okay, January. So yeah. Right.
So now I'm
you
here.
Left, and he probably said, "Boys, bring in the crew." As you hopped
he
on
did,
the plane,
pretty much
to get that amount of work done. One, you have to have the right equipment, have the right crew, and the right determination. But he just flat got after it.
Oh, and that's just part of what he did. Like,
right.
I laid out 2 new food plots. And you know me, I don't typically lay out new food plots for a landowner.
Yeah.
Because usually what we find are that acres of food plots that are there aren't getting maximized anyway. So before we go and bring the dozers out, let's maximize what we have here. Mm-hmm. And he really wanted some new food plots.
Boom.
And
done.
We wanted to diversify it. So
they're in.
2 new food plots in and look. I mean, chin-high clover and wheat everywhere.
So they were planted in the fall.
Oh, yeah.
Done
yeah.
within the first
yep.
6 months.
Yep. And then also trying to add more diversity.
Mm-hmm.
Expanded a couple clear cuts that were already there, pushed out stumps, a lot of stumps, planted warm season grass mix
mm-hmm.
so we can get some more bedding. And more cover
mm-hmm.
That they're not going to be eating.
Yep.
So we want native grasses.
A little
about
bit
6
out.
Acres, 6 to 8 acres of native grasses. And then also one thing haven't mentioned yet, but northern climate, and I think some people may be shocked to hear us say this, but we also laid out some evergreen thermal pockets. And instead of going with the vast acres of it, of like saying, okay, well, I've got 16 acres of white pine over there. We're talking very similar mm-hmm. to our micro clear cuts, 1 to 3 acres where he mm-hmm. went and he planted white pine, red pine,
yep.
eastern hemlock.
Mm-hmm.
And he planted those last year. Now, he didn't specifically, his son wanted me to point that out. He didn't specifically plant those.
He was the guy pointing from the truck. Y'all get out there and plant. However, they got planted.
Yep. And then he also, and through our ongoing conversation, talking about woody browse being crucial mm-hmm. and going, what do you think is the best woody browse that mm-hmm. I could add? And I'm like, well, all that young forest regen is going to be amazing. But if we're looking for a species, if you're trying to pin me in a corner of a species that's native to your region that I do like, red osier dogwood.
Mm.
He goes out and he bought, I don't know. From, I think, PA, or one of the
Forestry
nurseries up there. He bought red osier dogwood cuttings and seedlings, 20 cents a piece or whatever.
Yeah.
Hundreds of them.
Yeah.
Plugged them all through his wet areas.
Yeah.
So now he's going to, and, all right, we've said this before, but I want to make sure everybody understands this. Because we see this. How many times do we see trees planted in tubes scattered on the landscape?
No. Better question.
How many times do you see tubes thrown out across the landscape?
Well, that too. But how many times do you see trees cut for other trees to be planted? And I say that on the heels of what you said with the evergreen, but that's a different situation.
Yeah.
But literally, hard mass trees cut to plant hard mass trees or fruit bearing trees.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
Okay. Keep going.
Yep.
But anyhow.
So, yeah. So he planted all this red osier dogwood, which I don't think he had a single one on his property last year. Now he's got hundreds of seedlings planted. And what he did, because if anybody's been around red osier dogwood in the northern climate, where deer numbers are high, they hammer it. And you won't hardly grow them if mm-hmm. they find it. So he went, and after all this timber cutting, he's got treetops everywhere. Where does he put the cuttings?
In
through
the
treetops. So they're protected for the time being. And 5 years from now, those treetops will be broken down more. Those dogwoods will be popping out. And so he's going to add those. He's got flowering dogwoods there, which mm-hmm. were in full bloom when I was there. So he's looking to add some of those. Do a little hinging with them to try to mm-hmm. get some more woody browse. But I couldn't be more proud of these two landowners, because it's not just one piece. They did the same thing just down the road on the other guy's property, working together, forming a little co-op.
I love it.
And adding some incredible diversity. And doggone it, I wouldn't be surprised if he don't have a 150 in the coming years.
Oh, sure. If you're, again, looking at addressing the critical points, check, doing all of that.
Yep.
It's a matter of time, letting some more deer get to age in
the area. Trying to get as many friends and family in there shooting does as possible.
Sure. And then adding the cover so you can carry over more of the each age class into the next year.
Yeah.
It's sometimes, and depending on your region, can be a long-term game. But if you don't do the drastic things, if you don't do the crazy, the wild, and get after it, every year you wait, you're that much farther potentially behind from reaching that goal. So good on him. That's fantastic, because that's aggressive. And there's no other way to address it than to get after it when you have the time and the equipment there on site. So those who are doing forestry management practices and or have logging coming, if you have the means, if your invasive species are under control on your site, and you saying, if I can get more money for the harvest and I can utilize some of the trees that I would be cutting through TSI, but I'm just afraid that logger is going to go ahead and maybe take a few extra, I'm going to say the sunlight's, if wildlife is your goal over Tim, get after it.
Absolutely. And that was our big question last year, was it was kind of like, but if I open up the sunlight, am I going to have more Japanese stillgrass? Well, I told him, I said, I don't know how you operate on your farm, but I'm going to tell you how I operate on my farm. I don't live in fear of what could happen when I know what I have isn't doing anybody any good. And so
guess what?
He hammered it. Now, this is what I love so much about this landowner, or these two landowners, is the ability to get things done.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times we live in this, you know, if time is limited and you listen to our podcast, you're like, okay, I gotta get rid of the invasives.
Yeah.
You go, well, when do I have time to make better habitat? Now, removing invasives is making better habitat.
Yeah.
But
step one,
if time is limited and you're like, I need to TSI that, or I need to put in bedding thickets, but I also need to go spray those invasives, you're like, how can I ever get ahead? He used this year, hammered it. And mm-hmm. and by the way, because of the paper mill and having the ability to thin the forest, he now has something few of us get to really see. A woodland
mm-hmm.
with really, really, really healthy, great crowned, beautiful trees still standing. Yeah. He cut the junk trees.
He cut the weeds.
And made money on it. And
so you're saying that you can improve timber and wildlife at the same time?
I'm saying you can have your cake and eat it too.
Absolutely. You got to do it right.
And so this man is managing for a healthy forest.
Mm-hmm.
And he's managing for timber value. And he is improving the health of his deer. Shoot, they're getting some really nice young deer
sure.
on camera.
Yeah, yeah.
And I've said it so many times, you can't have your cake and eat it too. We just have to know how to do it.
Yeah.
And a lot of times, if you don't believe that, you haven't figured out how to do it yet.
Multi-use properties are a thing.
Yeah.
100% they are.
I've said this so many times, but if you're thinking, well, I can't have trophy deer and quality timber, I gotta go cut my timber, or I'm gonna go hinge it over.
Or I can't have cattle and I can't have
You might as well
deer.
Drive down the road and throw $20 bills out the window, because you're just wasting away money.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, if you're not managing for income, at least to make the payment, then
or property tax or something.
There's better ways to throw away money, because you could, who knows, buy that adjoining property or mm-hmm. buy that whatever, that deer blind, so you and your grandkids or kids can hunt together in bad weather.
Sure.
Whatever it is. And so this guy, man, I'm so happy. So he used this past year to really get the habitat to where he wants
mm-hmm.
it. And now he's get to spend, he's not real thrilled about the second one, because he's making a whole lot of money thinning that forest.
Yeah.
Now he's going to use this year to get rid of invasives.
Yeah.
And so, and how many times, it's almost like you need another lens. You have to put on a naturalist lens, because his place, the understory, had patches of Japanese barberry.
Mm-hmm. Probably multiflora rose.
Multiflora rose, a little bit, yep.
Yeah.
Japanese stiltgrass.
Oh, yeah.
Those were the main ones. Now, we go down, and in this town, there wasn't much to eat. PA was still kind of under this quarantine area
mm-hmm.
deal. Burger King. Pull in a Burger King. What's the landscaping? Japanese barberry. All of them planted. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, what are we doing to ourselves? Like, why do we keep doing this?
We're intentionally bending over and then put it on our own foot where, you know, yeah, it's like, golly.
So today, I'm driving through town and we're going to pick strawberries. We swing by McDonald's. What do you know in their landscaping? Right here in Springfield, Missouri. Japanese barberry.
Sure.
Why are we so stupid? Why have we...
Well, it's pretty. What? Come on, man.
It's not even pretty.
Honestly, that's the thing that gets me. It has thorns, and it's not even that pretty. So liability landscaping-wise, why do you want the thorny bush planted everywhere across the country where your pedestrians and your customers are walking through, cutting through? I don't get
it. So in some landscaping, what they do is they advise putting thorny bushes in front of your windows, so in case you have break-ins or whatever, people don't want to go through a thorny bush.
You know what hurts worse than a thorny bush? A pistol.
Shotgun.
Yeah. 9mm.
Yeah. But at the same time, it's like, so that's a big part why they use these thorny bushes in Japanese barberry landscape. But it's just so frustrating because you just, another one was Japanese, what was it called? Wineberry.
Wineberry, yeah.
Yep. Yeah. And...
Did you see a lot of brows on it?
No.
Really?
No. Interesting. None. I barely any.
Huh.
I'm not even sure if I saw any.
Wow.
Yeah. And obviously that part of the world, if it's edible, it's getting brows. And they weren't eating on it too much.
I wouldn't say inner city Maryland, but a lot of the extremely high deer density right outside of D.C., and naval bases and things like that around there got it. It was getting eaten. It was getting hit. Wineberry, anyhow. Actually, the fruit's not bad on them.
Yeah.
Not that I'm a proponent of invasives, but just saying.
Yeah.
The berry wasn't
bad. Tastes terrible. Trust me. I tried it. It was awful. Yeah. Oh, before we continue this podcast, we want to also take time to thank another one of our partners, Make It Happen, Vortex Optics. Matt, is it?
Legacy 20. Go to their website. And on the apparel site and side of things, they've got some awesome gear, and you guys have access to that gear at a discount. Use the code LEGACY20 on VortexOptics.com for all of their apparel. Be sure to check them out.
Yeah, I almost said I had to look down because I'm almost always wearing a Vortex shirt.
Like, I always find myself.
I've got a... 17-month-old girl. Like today, I've wore 3 shirts, and the second shirt I put on, I looked, I'm like, there's peanut butter and banana smeared on my shirt. Time to go change. So usually I'm wearing a Vortex shirt, but anyway, so this place has got invasives, so he's going to spend the next year taking care of them. And you know, and now here's the big thing. He's cut so much timber that I visited in May, so through that first big growing season, and there's already stump sprouts up 6-12 inches, and the clear cuts look amazing, and
they're well on their way.
There's maples. You know how much they love maples in northern climate, and red maples and sugar maples just growing, and it's like now the biggest thing biggest thing we need is time. We just need this to grow.
This needs to mature, like in a mature from a habitat standpoint, because then when it gets to that point, then you start doing the fun stuff. And I know Pennsylvania's getting a prescribed fire count, so they're starting to allow that and get the works in. But you just need to let it mature and get to that stage, and then just keep it there, just maintain it. And after that, man, it's like,
he asked me about fire when I was there, and I said, I think they're close. They're much closer today than they were yesterday at having fire. And he's like, so what does that look like? And I'm like, man, with all his timbering.
Oh, sunlight.
He's got these roads.
Oh, yeah.
It's like all we have to do is just start lighting her up because his roads are phenomenal. And now he's got units everywhere, so he's going to be burning and setting that multifloral and barberry and all that stuff back anyway.
That's awesome.
I could not be more excited. It's one of my favorite projects so far since starting Land and Legacy, because we're going into an area. It's just like Jason Brazda, who was on the podcast.
Yeah, from Michigan.
Michigan. We're going into some of these areas where the idea is you can't grow good deer. Like,
yeah.
It's going to be really tough. And, you know, through stepping away from the food plots and doing more of a big scale management, we're changing the landscape.
Well, and I think when I say big scale management, it's big scale from a, you're addressing the largest portions of the property, but two, you're doing it aggressively. And that was one of Jason's biggest things that he talked about is, hey, once I saw that there was success here and how deer related to it, and they saw this as cover, I said, I need to get those guys back and do more.
Yeah.
And this guy in Pennsylvania, he was essentially, I'm just going to do it all because I know how deer can relate to logging,
yeah,
and timbering, and I'm just going to go ahead and just go ham on it.
Yeah.
And just knock it out. And
yeah.
Wow.
And, you know, sometimes when we lay out bedding thickets on a map, it's like, if they would just cut half of that, we'd be great.
Honestly, it's like, year one, if you cut half, 50% of what's laid out to do year one, and you hunt them, and you see how wildlife react to it, I know that the rest will get done in time. Because you can't experience it and watch it and see that change and spend time around it and not know that's not benefiting and reaching your goals, let's say.
Yeah.
It's incredible. And yeah. And we're saying that because the start in a lot of areas is so far away from quality that anything helps.
Oh yeah.
Any little
bit helps.
If
they go in and cut a quarter acre with a chainsaw, we know deer are gonna use it because it's so limited.
Yeah, don't be surprised. But take that as a sign and say, quarter acre, let me do 2 1/4 acres, and then we go over there and do another 1 1/4, then I'm going to do 1 3/4 over,
yeah,
here. Keep going, keep doing it.
So when this guy went in to cut his, I mean, we looked at every single clear cut that he had, and every time I stepped over, I was like dang, this,
yeah,
is a big area.
Uh-huh.
Like, he cut the, what I laid out on the map was cut.
Yeah.
And it's like, woo.
Well,
I can't wait. And I mean, I'm just, oh, my fingers are crossed. I hope that one day rough grouse are on that place.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
And
you didn't hear any in the spring?
No.
Up there? Gotcha.
No. And they don't really know. There's been a few. Well, one of the properties I worked had a few. The guy, mm-hmm, sees them. So they're in the area, but it's,
yeah,
just like, man, I just, the day he calls me to say, mm-hmm, you won't believe it, I'm going to be like, that's when it's going to be like,
put have that, you heard them in the spring? Have you been able to hear
I
them?
I haven't been to a property that,
really,
has them. No.
It took me some time growing up before I knew what it was.
Yeah, I've never even heard one because,
man, you don't spend that much time in the east anyhow.
No, or the north during that,
yeah,
time of the year.
Yeah.
Because, you know, this year is a little different for us, but we typically do our hardcore consulting from in the spring, winter and spring. And then we're so busy, real estate, turkey season, planting season, we don't do a lot right there in that window of time. And this year was like, we're turkey season, come and gone, we're planting season. No, Chad, sorry, you got to do it. We're still on the road.
We got more months of this, which is a fantastic blessing and an awesome reminder that there's a lot of people who want to make some land better.
Yeah,
and
for sure.
I love that. I love, yeah, getting those emails in and then getting those pictures back of seeing that the stuff that you recommend is actually getting put into place. It's
that
powerful.
Yeah, that property, those two properties, because they're right there less than a mile apart, and they're going through the same process.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, that project is something that I hope many of their neighbors,
mm-hmm,
many people in that part of the world who believe, who have bought the phrase that you can't make a difference in that part.
If it's going to happen,
we're
going to
throw
that
phrase in the trash and say,
yeah,
watch us.
Mm-hmm.
Watch us do it.
Yep.
And same thing with Jason Brazda. It's like,
yep,
you can't make a big difference on small acreage in Michigan. Watch us.
160-some-inch deer.
Well, I thought it was 157 or 163, somewhere
right
in there.
Something like that.
And, you know,
we're not
taking credit for all the work, but
no,
we are certainly helping them line out and try to make the biggest,
mm-hmm,
bang for their buck. And
yeah.
And Jason, and Ryan both are doing some cool things, and I hope to get back up there in the future.
Yeah. So, Minnesota.
Minnesota, yeah. I was like, wow. We might have to hold on to that one for another podcast, but here we are. We got 12 minutes, so.
Oh, thanks. This is eerie, similar to your hunt with Chad this year at turkey season. Oh, thanks. You gave me I have 20 minutes to kill a turkey. Thanks, yeah. Adam. I have 12 minutes to
imagine
fit
a lot
three
of
different
stuff
properties in Minnesota.
Happened.
So, yeah, no, it was an awesome trip because you want to talk about a diverse state. When you look at it and let's just take Minnesota and Wisconsin and you look at their landscapes from a historical standpoint and you can't help but look at it, that map, and just study and be like, I want to go to every single one of these different colors. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, do a little bit of research and look at the different ecoregions between the two different states. And it's fascinating and it's incredibly cool to almost go and do like the forensics on the property and be like, wow, this used to be this, or this was just super cool. And now what we're seeing is, pockets of monster bur oaks on 2 foot elevation changes, and then everything around it transitions down into maple and then a credible amount of shrubs and then native grass, switchgrass, then blends into bogs and lakes. It's like, everywhere you look, there's water, but then everywhere you look, there's like pockets of hardwoods, pockets of evergreens, pockets of shrubs. And it's just like, wow, there's so much up here, which is cool. And one thing that did surprise me a little bit was the number of oaks up through some of that region.
Yeah.
Primarily there was, bur oak and northern red oak. There was some white oak, but, pretty scarce through there. And then the shrubs. It was like you drove and you went to shrub town. I like 8 different varieties, easy. Red osier, nine bark, nanny berry, American plum, gray dogwood, high bush cranberry, and then of course there was the invasive buckthorn everywhere.
Yeah.
And that's just to name a few.
Yeah.
But it was incredible to go and see that. But also, like you talked about earlier, if there were not that composition, say the amount of shrubs present in the landscape, there would not be deer.
Yeah.
The incredible winters that some of these areas visiting experience. I mean, we're talking routine, 1.5 to 2 foot of snow in some of these places.
Yeah.
And so when you look at the structure and the understory,
or snowshoeing is a hobby, like they actually
go
out.
To. Yeah. They're snowshoeing, they're cross country skiing, we're snowmobiling, green alder, all those everywhere alders. But if you don't have them, you're not going to have wildlife.
Yeah.
Because the amount of browse that those things take.
White-tailed deer.
Yes. Well, even rough grouse.
Yeah.
Rough grouse are up there, and they're eating on all the buds. And they just provide so much forage for a bunch of different wildlife that they're so important. And, going in there, it was, wow, look at all these. But then when you started walking, it was that reminder of, okay, this is a lot of shrubs, but if there was not this amount, man, this would be a desert from that wildlife standpoint. So it was good to see, but then it was like you really looked at the overstory and said, if you're not worth it, if you're not doing anything, you have to be gone.
Yeah.
Because what I know is going to come back is going to be beneficial shrubs.
Yeah.
And you have to be gone because you need that sunlight back down there to regenerate and get more shrub colonies out there in the landscape. Sumac everywhere too. I mean, there was...
What kind?
Staghorn and rough. And then there was... Not that any of it was leaving out at this point.
Yeah.
But...
Really? What's it?
Some of it was older, but then when they get super old, they like and they're just like very slow. But some of the sumac was browsed around, like the bark itself was consumed above the snow line. We saw that in several places, eating the cambium layer. The
you said
bark
rough.
There.
I think you meant dogwood. Did
I
you
say
mean
that?
Smooth?
Smooth sumac.
Okay.
Yeah.
You said rough, and I had to question myself for a second.
Yeah.
I was like,
wait a second.
I
here.
Don't know if I know that one. Yeah.
So that was awesome to see. But a lot of these properties, when we're talking food plot in the north, clover year round, let's say outside of snow, great. It's like always good for growing
never
clover.
Never burns up on the
snow. And you don't have to worry about it. It's awesome. Yeah. And it does well. It insulates decent underneath of a lot of snow.
Yeah.
So it comes out of spring and pops very soon because it is insulated a little bit. But then it comes out just roaring and then it's good all the way till through, you know, most of October.
Yeah.
But you have to have some standing grain. And I know that soybeans are so good. Right?
Yeah.
That's what we all hear.
Overrated.
But it's like, if I'm in a northern climate and I have higher deer densities and I have to have grain above snow, I don't want them to be foraging on that grain production because I know how critical it is going to be. I don't want them foraging on that species during the summer months.
Yeah.
Like, you're going to have to devote some food plots to. This isn't going to be maybe great growing season food, but it has to be there, has to be present late season. So species like corn, species like milo, where that grain is going to be above snow and they're not crushing it during the
growing season.
Because like when you go to some of these places, and a lot of the rec property has water on it, and so it floods, there's lakes. The amount of areas that are actually open for planting isn't a lot. Like, it's a heavily forested area. So
if you plant something like soybeans, there's a good chance it gets crushed.
Pounded. Yeah. And that's not everywhere across the state, of course. However, you have to be very intentional and know, okay, if I do this, why am I spinning my wheels and wasting time? I'm worried about winter. I'm worried about hunting season. Come November, I mean, we're in snow. We're 10 inches of snow, easy, routinely out there. So you have to be very mindful of that. And they're planting, corn was already popping up there, which was crazy. But corn was popping up there. So as you're coming out of winter, as a manager in those states, you have to be ready and preparing for the next winter. Like, there's no downtime in there. And whether you're probably just a resident up there or you're working on behalf of wildlife, it's like your mind better be focused on winter every single time. So one of the properties, there was a lot of openings. This actually had some more open areas. It was old pasture, smooth brome, Reed's Canary. But we're going to plant some evergreens.
Yeah.
I mean, there was in the lookout, because deer will definitely travel late season in areas like that.
Huge ranges.
Massive ranges. Where's the food source? Where's the cover? They can yard up. We've got to have that. Like, if it's not in the region, let's create it.
Same thing in PA. Like, if you have both that evergreen pockets and the late winter food, you own the deer herd for that specific time.
Own it.
And the more you have of both of those, the more deer you can hold, and gives you a better ability to harvest deer during the hunting season.
Yeah, like, absolutely.
It's not that complicated.
It's a very simple game.
And I think, you know, last year I dealt with this with one of the landowners. Is he had a lot of white pines just growing up naturally and understory.
Yeah.
A lot of them are 15 foot tall, stacked in high stem density, thick as a hair on a dog's back.
Yeah.
And just so much so that there wasn't even that many needles on they were at the very top because they're all competing with each other.
Yeah.
It was like, when you're cutting, just smash those, like, because they're not doing
our
purpose.
It's an evergreen. but it's not doing anything.
Yeah, so we found a lot of that too. Planting at a high density, similar to like a Christmas tree plantings, where we're trying to get the real shrubby evergreen to where there is some sunlight underneath. That's going to help melt some snow. But on days where, you know, late winter, you get that 6 out of the 7 days are cloudy.
Yeah.
But they can still get in those evergreens. But at the same time, when that sun does pop, they can still be bedded in that area and they can just soak it up.
Mm-hmm.
And it'll help melt that snow.
But then you get a lot of food in those same areas too during the growing season. So that's exactly what one of these sites was going to have and be recommended, is to plant it, but plant at the right density. We're not stacking things in. And even along the area, like, it was really actually pretty cool. There was a lake, and then I would say around this 14-ish acre lake, 40% of the edges were all what we would, I'm air quoting, bogs.
Yeah.
So there was like so much vegetation essentially floating a foot below the surface of the water, cattails coming up through it. The guy, he went and put pallets across it. And so you could walk out to the water's edge through this bog on pallets, and you're floating. It's like a suspension bridge.
Yeah.
And it was really kind of cool. I hadn't really experienced that. But you're floating in there and sitting in 6-inch deep water, but walking across these pallets. So he's going to be floating across this lake and then walking on pallets across the bog to get to some of these stand sites.
Oh, that's
cool.
It
sounds treacherous, but it's like that access and that wind blow it right back across this lake, dude. That's killer. It's awesome.
Yeah,
so that was another cool feature. But that's the state in general. Boy, it's cool.
Yeah,
it reminds me a lot of Maine, like almost identical to something. Probably it has more ag for sure, the parts of Maine that I've visited. But species wise awesome, really really neat.
How
Lost
is it
spruces,
as far as
crystal clear water
invasives?
So the
comparison.
The biggest invasive is European buckthorn. And we saw some sites and we saw some areas that it was going to be tough.
Yeah.
I mean, we're talking honestly one of the best recommendations, because they're all shrubs. We're talking 3-inch DBH stuff. Is getting one of those steel, like a weed trimmer, but with the circular blades on them. And getting after them.
Burning not help?
Burning wood. Some of the sites pretty
fuel.
Residential. And then not enough fuel. I mean, it was so, like, some of them was like growing underneath aspens.
Mm.
And then it was very, we go and we walk through stuff all the time. That's like, shoot, we're busting through that. It was like, that made me want to think twice about going through that one. Thick. And I was like, I'd love to be able to burn it, but it's just not burnable right now.
Yeah.
Like, we do not have fuel to be able to carry a fire.
Hmm.
So water everywhere.
Yeah.
We saw sandhill cranes in a clear cut.
Yeah.
I'd never seen that before in my life. But we had a landowner contacted us late last year, and new scheduling wise, gonna make the most sense to do May. So we had worked kind of online prior to the visit, and he had clear cuts. He had hired a logger and said, hey, I want these areas cut, had them done during the frost. So they actually drove equipment, logging equipment, skidders across the bogs when they're frozen solid, pulled out, did these clear cuts, and they looked beautiful. I mean, they took everything. When they said clear cut, it was gone out of there, pulled it out, and they were able to utilize a majority of that. But the balancing of all these different landscapes, we're talking foot to 2 foot changes in these areas, and you have a different suite of shrubs that are coming back. You have a lot of potential water standing everywhere. It was very, very cool, but crazy. Like,
it's
you could totally tell that deer are going to be extremely bottlenecked on some of these portions of the property. And it was like, I'm going to set up knowing that after walking this place, wet years, even minor wet years, that's not going to be wet. That's going to be dry. There's your bottleneck. Let's work and hunt, manage in and around some of these areas. And most of them had 4 or 5 of those areas that were like, man, this is killer. This is really, really good. So a lot of different challenges, but a lot of cool things to think through, consider being up there. But regardless, the winter was insane.
Yeah.
And the last family that I went and saw, both the husband and the wife, their dream was basically to have a kind of a vacation home with their family close to a lake. They bought this place, ended up getting more land than what they really had initially set out for. But now, like, the lake is an afterthought, and they are 100% devoted to this property. And they're bringing their family involved. Like, just the atmosphere, very similar to Pennsylvania. Lots of hunters, lots of people outdoors. And they love the winter up there. I think they're crazy. But they're talking about all this silly stuff that they do outside in the winter. I'm like, y'all, you know it's like zero, though. But they're so used to it.
But it's a dry zero.
Yeah.
Down south.
Sure.
Down southwest. So it's like 120. Yeah, but it's a dry heat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
if you were to give me the option to spend my summers in, like, Mississippi or my winters in Minnesota, I'd probably take winters in Minnesota over summers. And I hate summer. I hate the heat.
Today, walking outside, I went for a quick run. And yeah. I walked outside, it was midday, I was like,
yeah,
I don't like this. No. It's like, as soon as turkey season hit, it just switched. It's like, summer.
Yeah, but it's supposed to rain all week, so it'll be cool again.
Yeah. But yeah, great family. Great family.
That's
so
awesome.
Shout out to them.
Speaking of the elevation, one thing that in Pennsylvania, you can almost see the elevation and the veins of sand correlating with low bush blueberry everywhere.
Yeah.
It kind of felt like home, to be honest with you, minus the chestnut oak scattered through and lack of blackjacks. But yeah, it was like, oh, look at that low bush blueberry. But
was there enough elevation through the state that you could look on some of the mountains and see the spring green up, the difference? Was there enough elevation through there?
There wasn't. I'm trying to think here.
Sometimes that's cool going
probably
through.
I mean, because I was where I was at, there was 600-foot mountains or even more probably. I think so. But there, it was so early and green up that I even down in the valleys, it wasn't green enough much.
Yeah. And they had a couple late snows, frost up there too. That I think
it snowed during turkey season for them. They were griping about. Yeah. It's kind of like we talked early on. I know there's a lot of listeners probably dealt with this, but we talked how it seemed like spring green up was happening early this year. It was like every week or 2 weeks, then we get hit with a frost. It was like, bring the brakes, pump the brakes to where now we're in middle of May or late May. We're still going. We haven't really dealt with heat yet.
Yeah. Well, and
knock on wood.
Here's the other constant reminder. Don't get ahead of yourself planting. Like, you're not winning any awards when you're planting food plots and you're the first guy in your area. Sorry, but you're probably not gonna, they're not gonna make it.
So three out of 5 years, something bad's gonna happen.
Yeah, like, that's not the trophy to be putting on a wall, because no one hands it out, because you have springs like this where it's gonna completely trick you, and then you're gonna be behind the eight ball when you get that late frost or multiple late frost snows.
Or cold and rainy, so the seed sits there and rots.
Rots, yep.
Yeah. We haven't planted yet. And
I ain't worried about, like, oh, no, we don't have food. No. It's kind of like, whatever, they're doing fine. I got time.
Everything's still green in the food plot, so it's all good.
Yeah.
There was one last thing. So, top three favorite species that you found in Minnesota.
Found
Not like that they were new, but like oh, there it is, there's the all-American that I was looking
red
for.
Red osier was absolutely everywhere because there's so much wet and
like
whatever. I mean, it was
might
like,
as well be the state shrub.
Oh yeah, I mean it
might be the state shrub. I don't know,
if not it ought to be, because it was just like some areas just like a red hint. It was just like,
oh, it's still red.
Oh yeah,
yeah,
yeah. It was beautiful.
It was so talking with this landowner, he's like, I don't know what it looks like. This is a funny story. He goes, I don't know what it looks like. Like I said, it gets a real red stem in the winter, and it's just like almost bright red. He's like, man, where I feel like I've seen that. And he while I was up there, he goes, you know what? Here's a funny story for you. I found it. I knew where it was. He said, that's the shrub that I have to cut back every year because it slaps my mirrors when I'm driving out of my driveway.
That's funny.
Red osier. But I didn't see enough of it to qualify it. I would say American blackberry because in all his cutting, blackberry's just coming
pounded
up.
Back, yeah.
And another really awesome one that I just really, you know, we don't get to see it a lot where we're at, but in that part of the world, kind of keys in with rough grouse and
I know, Shane.
Logging it.
That was going to be mine too.
Aspen.
I just pulled up that picture. There's one of the big lakes.
It's just
lakes,
so pretty. Yeah.
It's just beautiful.
Did you run into
light.
Any tamaracks?
I saw them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Driving around, but on the property that we were working, no. Yeah. There were none, no tamarack
gotcha.
Swamps or larch yeah. is another.
And then the other one I like is Eastern Hemlock.
Yeah. I do. I love little pine cones on them.
Yeah.
Little cones, I guess. Eastern Hemlock is pretty. I would say I'm going to hit on the aspen, but then I see it all the time, and we talk about it nonstop. But some of the bur oaks up there,
yeah.
I mean, they were cool. Like, because again, you go to those eco regions across the state, and there was prairie, there was more swampland, but regardless, there were still bur oaks spread throughout it. And my mind just was like, go back 300 years and try and picture what this place was, and it was just high knobs with beautiful bur oaks everywhere. I mean, there's some monster trees out there.
You know,
huge wolfy stuff.
Going back to my roots.
Roots?
Being from the town of Little House on the Prairie.
Oh,
you know,
I saw it.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah.
Because a couple of the books were setting in
Mankato.
In Minnesota.
Yep.
Like on the banks of Plum Creek was Minnesota, I believe. And I think Little House in the Big Woods is Minnesota, if
yeah.
I remember right.
Mankato's a town they frequented, I guess, or there was some sort of setting. But, yeah, drove really close to it.
Yeah, Walnut Grove, too. But, yeah, so pretty cool trip.
Blue spruce were a cool thing, too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Just don't see them.
Yeah. Was there much wildlife usage and like, bedding, you think, with them?
So, the last property I visited was 40 acres, and the landowner's relative had 20 acres that was adjoining. And we just made a quick little loop through there, and they had primarily all evergreens, and this property didn't have any. So we didn't really spend much time. We just kind of saw the edge, and that was it. So I didn't spend much time in it to truthfully know and see.
Yeah. Well, hopefully you guys in the northern climate got something where you felt
yeah.
like we were talking to you in this week's podcast. And I know there's going to be more in the future because it sounds like, well, I'll be back in northern Ohio next month coming up. So
that's coming up
yeah.
pretty soon.
Actually, it'll be less than a month. But, yeah, and then I'll be in Texas next week. So
I know. Oklahoma, Kansas
Yuck.
This week, and then Virginia and Maryland coming up here soon.
Yeah. So, all right, guys. Well, hey, if you could, please head over to YouTube and check out our Land and Legacy YouTube channel and subscribe for us, please. You're getting ready to see some. We put our last turkey hunt of the year. We're saving some of the others for next year, but you're going to start seeing some more habitat how-to stuff coming out on that channel. So please go and subscribe to support us. Anyway, guys, we will catch you next week.
See ya.